that came out of the discussion section this morning that I might want to bring in. Yes?
Actually, I wanted to bring up something from last week's class. And I guess just kind of open the forum to talk about the ways in which we inquire. And I'm really curious, I've noticed kind of this shadow aspect for me of academia.
Can you close that window for a while?
The shadow side for me of academia, which is kind of speaking at each other and not necessarily hearing each other because we're like first criticizing. It's like we're coming from a space of asking questions sometimes where we're saying, I want to know what's wrong with your argument instead of trying to understand someone's argument. And I've noticing that happen, not just in this class, but in a lot of classes. And I'm not quite sure how to mediate that. I'm guilty of it as well, finding out what's wrong first instead of finding, like, seeking first to understand someone. And the only thing I can think of is maybe being willing to look at ourselves and say, like, is this question coming from a space of wanting to show what's wrong with the other person's argument? Or is this inquiry coming from a space of really like, I don't understand the argument? And so I guess that's just what I wanted to bring up. I was noticing that last week, and it just, I was particularly, I think, sensitive to it last week. It made me really uncomfortable, and it's obviously my own projection of me doing the same thing to other people and then not dealing with it in a way when other people are doing it, or me perceiving that other people are doing that. So, I don't know, I guess I just wanted to kind of talk about the shadow side I've seen. And it's not just this community, but lately it felt like I find everybody so brilliant in this community, and then we get to a point where we feel like we know so much, we can't really, it's like that Zen koan where you can't fill up the cup anymore because it's so full of our own academic knowledge that we can't hear other people speak to theirs. And, yeah, I guess that's what I wanted to say. I don't really know how else to say.
Anybody have any comment about that? I think it's a very important issue.
I was feeling that too. I'm not going to put it into words, but I was feeling uncomfortable.
Yeah. Anybody else want to say anything about that?
Yeah, I noticed the same thing. And I mean, I noticed it in my undergrad also, coming from a really traditional philosophy program. And I actually came here hoping to figure out how philosophy can use the philosophical dialectic, because there's something profound about this going back and forth. But I think after studying like Eastern philosophy in the way, say, a tradition like Buddhism progressed, it doesn't seem like there's a back and forth. It seems like you take an idea and you build on it, you take it, you build on it. Even if it seems like a rejection, it seems like it's publicly known that it's a collective building process. But in Western philosophy, the dialectic starts with the notion that there are two opposing views, as opposed to just the dialogue itself is one subject. And yeah, that's why I'm very, phenomenology for me presents this this in where we can watch the philosophical dialogue. Because I think what you're noticing is you were in it, and then you started watching it. And to me, that's profound. That means you were sitting in between the middle. You saw the two views going back and forth. And I think, yeah, if we can all figure out how to sit in the middle and understand how the two views are speaking to each other and not speaking at each other or against each other, especially in metaphysics.
Well, I've noticed that sometimes I get argumentative a little bit. And I know that when I get argumentative, I leave the class a little bit depressed. And I feel like I did something wrong. And so that's why I'm very interested in what you're bringing up, because I notice that sometimes happens. And I haven't been able to quite clarify for myself what triggers it. See, I'm not exactly sure. But I do know that I don't like doing it. And I do know that I don't know how the rest of you feel, but I personally would like help on this. Right? So like if I'm getting argumentative, maybe some of you guys could point it out and say, hey, you're getting argumentative. What's going on here? We could all try to figure it out together, because I want to know better. I don't want to have that happen when I'm teaching. So I'm interested in help on that. I'm really glad you brought it up. Yeah?
Well,
I think we also have to distinguish between a discussion forum, where we're here to have that kind of a dialogue where we're in the middle, and a class where we're here to learn a specific subject.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if we might want to set aside time in the class where this is when we're learning this model, and we're not going to argue about the model in a way that we're just going to try to understand it. And then we can set aside a time where now we're just philosophizing together, and this doesn't have to be our basis.
Well, I like that a lot.
I totally understand, but my issue with that is this was developed through the phenomenological process and through looking at experience correctly. I mean, correct?
Of course.
So I just feel like it would make sense for us to even understand it. We have to be invited into that looking at experience. And I don't think that happens if we're just sitting back.
Well, it's not a question of sitting back, but there is an issue. A very pragmatic issue, and that is that this is a classroom, like you're pointing out. Right? And you guys are here, unfortunately paying a lot of money, but you're here to learn something from me. This is an elective class, right? I spent my life trying to learn stuff, and I'm trying to shorten the process for you, right? And so I've developed this very elaborate perspective, and I'm trying to communicate to you, right? So if you guys want to raise skeptical objections about my entire philosophical enterprise, that's great. But I don't think it's fair to any of us to do that in class.
That's right? Not what I intend on doing. If it seems
like that, I wasn't speaking to you particularly. I was just making a comment about what Linda said, right? That I just think there's something about sort of us agreeing to accept that we're going to operate most of the time in this framework. By the end of the semester, you'll know enough about the framework to say, I like this, I want to explore it more, or I don't, and I'm done with it, right? But until you learn it, you can't make that decision. So there's something like that. I mean, there is something, but I'm not exactly sure what the boundaries of it are.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and in order to learn it, you have to bring your questions.
That's right.
So there, to me, though, what I notice is that for myself, I get into that kind of space too, but fortunately, I'm not the one who's talking most of the time. And so I'll listen to somebody say something, and in that moment, I'll go, "Wow, that's really bullshit." And then you'll respond, and you'll really get what they were saying. And to me, the difference is, and I think I noticed this in you in a similar way, and I don't know if you say what bullshit, but to me, the difference is not being able to be in the transphysical communication. So there's a question of being intuitive as well as using the intelligence.
Yeah.
There's a question of being in the magical and really getting the synchronicity.
Yeah.
And being able to weed out the part that's like, well, okay, this is something I need to clarify in what that person's bringing out. And the part that's like, okay, now I understand what they're asking about the system that I'm putting forward. So part of what I respond will be to get to the meat of their question. And then another part of it will be to say, well, you know, actually there's some further clarification that relates to where you're coming from. Mm-hmm. And to me, like intuition, whatever that means, that ability to resonate in the astral world or whatever you want to call it, that's critical.
It is.
Okay, and so I'm really trying to understand the astral world in particular. Over the last year, I've been paying a lot of attention. Mm-hmm. And you know, I'm the atheist in the class, right? And the materialist, quote unquote. But I'm really going with this, and I'm really trying to understand this. And what I'm noticing for myself, there was a period of about 6 weeks ago where I have a hip injury, and there are times when the pain is really tremendous. That pain was getting in the way of my ability to be intuitive. And so in the study group and in the class that particular day, I was having a little more of an edge. Mm. So I don't know what triggers that, but what I realized later was that there was a real pain here, but what was happening to me was I was not as able to tune into, to resonate with things in the astral world.
Yeah.
Which is where I mainly operate, you know? And so I think I see something for you where you're, you know, there's certain times where you're not riding that wave, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're not hearing the deeper question, you're hearing the question on the surface. And you're not able to break it down as much. And I'm sure that happens to everybody, but I've been studying that phenomenon, I think that's some of what's happening.
So I don't want to spend a lot more time on this because we're sort of, I don't think we're going to go further, but I do want to really thank you for bringing it up. And I want to reaffirm my commitment to what I call meta-communication. which means if the conversation in the class feels uncomfortable, if I seem off or somehow the energy seems off, I would be very grateful if any one of you would bring that up. And so we could talk about that while it's happening. Right? Because I think if we talk about it while it's happening, we'll be able to do something with it. And right now, it's a little bit too abstract for us to get our teeth into. But I think what Becky's saying is very important, and I don't want to lose sight of it. And so I really want to invite us to be brave enough to say, hey, something funny is happening in the room now. Let's look at it. I'll do it if I notice it, and I really want to encourage you guys to do it. If you feel uncomfortable, or you feel like somebody's getting shut up or whatever, let's all bring it up. Let's work together to improve the quality of our communication. And it's obvious to you, I think, that I'm quite willing to be the object of criticism if that's necessary to facilitate our learning process. Okay?
I would say I really appreciate that, because my usual reaction is to first sit here and being uncomfortable and then just like stare at my paper or be really awkward. Or is to leave the room, mm-hmm. and to actually be able to say something and be invited to say something, that means so much to me.
Well, yeah.
Because again, that just practices not only the boundaries for myself, but also the boundaries in my relationship with everyone else.
That's right.
So I really appreciate
it. Yeah, so you're being a little bit of a canary, and I really want to welcome your song.
Thank you. So we don't have to sing very much.
All right.
I just wanted to say, I really enjoy metaphysical bewilderment, so that, like I said, that disorientation is why I came, why I do philosophy. So please tell me if I'm pushing questions too much and we want to go back to something. I completely understand that not everyone enjoys that funny feeling.
Yeah. Well, on that note, the study group discussions, like, they could just go on and on and on, and we keep wanting to bring more in. And so Vladimir's thinking of setting up kind of a Gmail discussion where we can post a topic and then keep going on it.
Isn't there a way to do that right on?
Caucus.
Yeah. What?
We should be, if we had a caucus site.
I don't know what caucus, but can't you do that right on the CIS website?
Yeah.
Under our class, isn't there a place for setting up a discussion section
there? Yeah, there is.
Oh. Well, either way, that could be something also where you put your bewilderment up and we can continue the discussion outside.
I'd actually like to do a face-to-face discussion. I think you can't feel nervous.
Yeah, come early. If you have a time issue, that's too bad, but we're there and we're talking.
I understand. I actually started a long email about this over spring break. I was going to send to everybody. That's why it's really funny you brought it up, but I couldn't finish it. I didn't know how to put it in the words. Okay. This is cool.
Vladimir, let's you and I be in touch. I want to check on, see if we can just settle up instantly on CIS. Mm-hmm. But if not, I want to talk to you. So let's you and I be in touch by email and get this going, okay?
Right now, to see what we've
got. Again, this was in a certain core contents with the intentions of the people from Media Guild. They are planning to start a web page that could cover activities of all the programs and classes. Actually, they mean it to do just for PCC, but I would propose on the next meeting to make the page and to organize all the people.
Okay, but that'll take time, right?
Yeah, of course.
So let me go ahead and see if I can just set something up for the class, or at least for the discussion group right on CIS. If I can, I'll send an email about it to everybody. Not to get in the way of what you're doing, which sounds like a longer-term solution, but let's just stay in touch about it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Open discussion. We're looking on the website right now.
You're looking at my CIS.edu.
Under collaboration at a post.
So it's our class?
We're testing as we speak.
Testing.
Well, it's already there.
It's under, if you go to my CIS,
right,
to this course,
right,
on the left-hand side, there's a place that says collaboration.
You hear this, everybody? If you go to my CIS under this course, there's a place that says collaborate.
It's academics, then this course. Then there's a place that says collaboration, and underneath it, there's a place for forums and a place for chat.
So let's put up a forum.
At the time. So forums. And then you can hit post.
Okay, so I'll look at it when I get home today. If I need to set up a forum, I'll do it. But then we can start doing that, and I'll check in on it regularly. So. Excellent. Okay. Any other business then? Any other class business? Very well.
Should we confirm? Do we have an abstract?
Yes.
And an abstract?
What?
And an abstract too?
Yeah, and the abstract is one paragraph.
Okay.
So I would like to see an abstract and an outline. Now, I don't expect you to follow this outline slavishly when you write your paper. I just want to know that you have some idea of what you're up to and that you have some kind of organizational plan that I can discuss with you. But, you know, this is not, it's not going to be graded and it's for you, but I do want to see it. It is important that we get this thing moving, okay?
Yeah. I have another question. For people who are graduating this semester, do we need to turn our papers in any earlier or anything?
You have to ask Aaron.
Asked him. He said, I just wanted to check with you. He said there's, you know, you don't want to do an incomplete, but there's no, like, special early kind of thing.
Then that's fine.
I just wanted to make sure.
I'm generally pretty timely about reading papers, and if you're graduating, want me to read your paper first, just tell me. Okay. Great. So any questions from the study group?
Yeah. How many hours do we have? No.
Can I say one thing first?
What?
Yes,
please. Go for it.
A lot of the things that we talked about ended up going back into that realm of, well, we have to get out of space and time to answer these questions. And so I just want to be really careful that we're not bringing that into here because this model is in space and time. So just to kind of put that out there, that not everything that we're talking about really fits in somehow. You know,
well,
Aurobindo doesn't. Because he's
asked,
Aurobindo, it's outside of space and time at the beginning of the evolution. It's only when we come down to the mental
that
we're in space and time and have actual occasions. So we're talking about communicating with spirits or with these places that are outside space and time. You know, we had some interesting discussion about that, but I don't know if you want to hear. Because
I really appreciate your asking that question. I'm not sure of the answer because it seemed as of last week that we needed some of that to satisfy people's curiosity so we could actually settle into this part of the theory. So I'm willing to take 20 or 30 minutes now and discuss some of that. Since so many of you are curious, this is coming up. Is that okay with everybody?
Yeah.
Okay. So go ahead then. So thank you, Linda.
Okay. So do you want to proceed based on what you said, or do you want me to read some of these questions? How would you...
Well, it seems like maybe we should just give a brief overview, since those are just kind of separate questions.
Go ahead, then. Here's something on top of it.
Do you want me to read some questions for a minute while you...
No, just to emphasize that we're starting with experience. So we're starting, here are things that we experience, and we don't see how they fit into this. And so, like, one example would be people who use plant spirit medicine, and they commune with the spirit of a plant to get information. And from a lot of the reading, it sounds like, well, a plant doesn't have that. They don't have that kind of a higher grade personality like we do that we can communicate with. So there's one piece of evidence. And looking into the magical mutation and how people would say, well, we need caribou today. And they would somehow commune with the caribou, the keeper of the caribou, and caribou would appear when they needed it. This is my understanding of it. So again, what is it that's holding all those caribou together and kind of making these decisions? You know, we could look at rocks, too, and how do they play? And we could look at the whole earth, and I think there are some traditions or some shamanistic things where there are, you commune with the spirit or some kind of entity that has an oversight over all of nature, or the whole working that comes together. How does that fit into an actual occasion? Because is that outside of time and space? And if so, you know, can we make, are actual occasions too limited? Is it possible to have actual occasions that are outside of time and space? How would we communicate with them? How does that information filter into our aims? You know, that's kind of a big container of what we were discussing.
That's great. That's very clear. And I'd like to say a few words about it, if I can. There are two different, there's several different issues that you're bringing up. And one of them is the larger picture about the unconditioned, the background, the unity, soul and spirit. We're talking about that. And that's one issue. And then another issue is the detailed working out of the sort of the scientific implications of the theory. Right? So for example, if you go back to the early days of science, they had this big inspiration. The big inspiration was mechanism. Let's describe everything that happens in terms of mechanical interactions, right? So that got to be a big project. And everybody went out and started trying to do that in all these different ways, right? And so, you know, Newton got the tides and the movements of the planets, but then other people came in and began to solve all kinds of problems this way. So it became a big movement, right? So I'm trying to start a movement like that. See, I'm trying to say,
mechanism has failed us. We made a lot of progress with mechanism, but it's exhausted. We need something else. And so I'm suggesting that rather than mechanism, we build our conceptual universe up out of actual occasions. Now, the actual scientific work of doing that, if it ever gets started, will take hundreds of years. Every one of these specific questions has to be addressed, right? So somebody's going to have to go through all the different species, like slime molds and plants and animals, and try to figure out some way or other, if we're lucky, in some kind of experimental way, whether higher grade occasions are exactly involved and how they're involved and things like that, right? So I don't claim to have all those answers worked out. What I claim to do is to provide a language in which they can be interestingly asked. And then we have to work them out. So the questions you're asking are just the ones that need to be asked next. Now, in terms of some of those things, I have a couple of suggestions that might stimulate your thinking. And so one of them is that, you know, there's this whole issue of rocks and plants and whether they're democracies or whether they have occasions presiding over them. And I don't exactly know the answer to that question. It's one that's very much in flux in my own mind. It has occurred to me, and this idea came to me from a paper that Bill wrote, is that if you have, let's say, a rock, and all the different actual occasions in the rock are in some way ingressing the form of rock, the eternal object of rockness in some way, then the fact that they all share this same form, this same rockness, would probably make them objectify more fully in each other. They would become more intimate with each other by virtue of their formal resonance. And if they're interacting with each other more deeply because of formal resonance, then all of their grades will rise slightly. And so the rock, even if it doesn't have a presiding actual occasion, would still be a certain sort of nexus of elevated depth, of extra interiority by virtue of being a rock. And so you can start to see how there could be a sort of a meaningful field there without there necessarily being a presiding occasion. And then when you get to slime mold, it gets more complicated, right? So then the question is, do you have a presiding occasion that comes in and leaves depending on the conditions or what, right? I don't know. You see, these are all questions that have to be sorted out. This is how the metaphysical system becomes translated into a science, is by asking these questions really seriously, you know, and then thinking, well, isn't there any kind of experiment we could do that might tell the difference, and what would that be? And I don't know what the answer to the question is. These are the questions that have to be asked, right? So some of these questions are just the logical next steps, right? And so you asked, for example, about the plant medicines. That's a really good question. So this brings us to the other question you're asking, which is about the infinite, the unconditioned, and how that applies, right? So again, this is, I haven't fully worked this out in details. It's what I'm hoping to do in the next book I write, is to start all the way at the top and work my way all the way down. I haven't actually done it. I've worked out a lot of the pieces in my head, but I haven't gotten it all sort of, you know, tidied up. So one thing I can say is that in my thinking now, I'm thinking that there are, and this, by the way, is a Whiteheadian idea, that there are two kinds of occasions, infinite and finite, as another division, right, in actual occasions. Because for Whitehead, God is the sole infinite actual occasion.
This is exactly what we came up with.
Well, good.
An actual occasion that was infinite in character. And that was
right.
Seeing how we could communicate.
Well, beautiful. You guys are way ahead of me. That makes me totally happy. Okay, so, but I'm thinking that in fact, and Whitehead starts to suggest this one time, maybe in his very last fascinating and highly obscure essay called Immortality. He seems to suggest that there may be an infinite number of infinite occasions. And this is what Sri Aurobindo is suggesting. So the idea would be that our souls are infinite occasions. Right? And so our souls are infinite occasions that no
pragmatically their unity with the universe. Right? And so it's through them that, that both their aim and the universal aim get expressed in the lower grade occasions. Right? So that's sort of a, gives you the direction I'm thinking about in terms of answering those questions. Right? But the main thing I want to say is that the questions you're asking are just the ones that need to be asked to expand the system and develop it. Right, so I'm aware that this system has weaknesses because it's brand new, and because as I've said, I've come to believe that philosophy is actually a collage activity in some way, that there will never be a perfect coherent system, but rather, starting with the general approach that I'm presenting, if you guys begin working out results like, you know, a process analysis of the formation and decomposition of slime molds would be a great paper, right? You know, or like, you know, plant medicines. How do we account for the plant medicines in terms of process philosophy? I know at least one dissertation that was written about that that I think Sean has upstairs. But see, these become really interesting questions that you're asking, and they show me how deeply you're understanding. And they make me feel excited that I'm beginning to have colleagues to help me flesh this out and take it deeper. So do you have any more specific issues? Yeah.
Well, one of the questions relates to this issue of whether an actual occasion can exist outside of time and space. Now, you say explicitly in Chapter 7 that an actual occasion has to exist somewhere and some when it's
yes,
located.
Yes, I need to have said finite occasion.
Uh-huh, okay.
I didn't.
Okay.
Okay? That's an oversight on my part. I wasn't thinking about this issue when I wrote that. But in fact, everything I say in this book, unless otherwise qualified, refers to finite occasions. Basically, my decision was this. I wanted to write this book for the Esalen people. They're really interested in reincarnation, life after death. I wanted to try to keep it closer to science, and so I started from mind and worked my way down, and I ignored overmind and supermind and all the issues of the infinite in this particular working out of the ideas. And so in talking to you, I wanted to create a larger picture, especially because your curiosity so naturally drove you there. So I'm bringing that in. But in this book, I'm working with the finite occasions.
So actual occasions don't necessarily start at the level of mind, which is what you were reading.
On the involutionary arc, they do. But not on the evolutionary arc. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, but then what about finite and infinite?
Well, what I'm saying, you see, is that the most interesting thing about the involution is how does anything finite come out of the infinite? That's the interesting question, right? And so I've tried to work this out by showing that at the level of mind, where abstraction in objectification enters into the system, individuality, space, and time, and finitude all emerge simultaneously. So on your way down from the divine, you first get actual occasions. High-grade actual occasions come into being first at the mental level. And then in the involution, lower and lower grades of occasion come into being till you get to the quantum level. And then in that quantum vacuum, the evolution begins.
The evolution of the physical.
The evolution of the waking world, yeah.
Of the waking.
That's right.
Is there a physical manifestation of the infinite in the same way that the top of the evolution chart has infinite manifestations?
It's a tricky question. Sri Aurobindo talks about what he calls the inconscient, which is this kind of dark shadow of the divine. And I'm making the experiment. I still can't commit myself to this. Every time I say it, I say I'm making the experiment. But I'm making the experiment of identifying the inconscient with the subatomic. Right? In which case, it wouldn't be a one, it would be a multiplicity of individual unities. Right? That would be sort of the bottom. But again, this is all very speculative. So it's just how I'm putting it together at the moment. Yes?
So, are you
saying that there are no actual occasions at the level of overmind and supermind?
I'm saying there are infinite occasions.
They are. So
there are infinite
actual occasions, but not finite actual occasions.
Right. Now, whether the extent to which infinite actual occasions, I mean, I haven't worked this out. Right. It needs to be worked out. You know, a Whitehead worked out his idea of the one infinite occasion with some detail, and his working out is interesting. And I have not worked out this notion to my own satisfaction, exactly what the properties of infinite occasions would be. I want to say they're infinite occasions because they are individuals in some way. Right? And so they are individual centers of consciousness which nonetheless know themselves to be one with the other centers, certainly at the overmind level. And at the supermind level, they also know themselves to be one with that which gave rise to all of them. But they're also individuals, right? So whether one, well, I'm not even sure we can call them occasions, but they're infinite individuals. And it may be that because we're dealing with either timelessness or eternality, we can't really talk about occasions. I just haven't worked exactly all this out.
So it's analogous to a finite actual occasion in some ways.
It's an individual, it's analogous to a finite occasion.
Yeah.
And in that it makes decisions, it's analogous to a finite occasion. How else it's analogous, I haven't yet really worked out. And this would be a great... If anyone wants to help me with this, that'd be wonderful.
You mean if there's one presiding occasion that's infinite in duration? Is that the infinite actual occasion?
Spatial.
What do you mean? I didn't say there's one. I said there's a large number of infinite actual occasions, not just one.
But
for Whitehead, there's one.
But in their infinity, it's in their duration or in their...
It's also in the fact that they're completely identified with all the others, right? So there's no boundary to them, right? They're actually infinite. They think infinitely. They don't think in finite terms. They think in infinite terms. How do you do that? I don't exactly know.
Well, I'm just thinking if you could differentiate between two infinite
beings. Yes, you can. I believe it's possible to, but maybe by their values. But again, the point is, what you guys are asking here are very legitimate questions about a large extension of transpersonal process metaphysics that I haven't written yet and don't really know the answers to, right? So, you know, if somebody else wants to write it, that would save me a lot of trouble.
So another question is, do the infinite, whatever they are,
let's call them infinite
occasions, do they transmit their aims?
Yes.
And if so, how? Because you say in chapter 7 here, everything actual comes into being in a process that involves, one, feeling or apprehending its past or causal efficacy. Two, feeling the halo of possibilities surrounding the emerging moment, which is conceptual apprehension. Three, forming an interpretive cascade of propositions, propositional apprehensions, and then deciding whatever needs to be decided.
Right.
I'm assuming that however the infinite gets communicated to the actual, it has to be in that second thing, the conceptual apprehension somehow. It has to be transmitting a halo of possibilities.
Hold on. Now, that's a very interesting thing you're saying, because that's certainly it's a very Whiteheadian idea. Because that's what Whitehead would say, is that the infinite occasion. Well, Whitehead says, in one of Whitehead's theories, he says that the halo of possibilities comes from the mind of God at the beginning of the concrescence, by what he terms a hybrid physical prehension. That's a very ugly word. And what he means is this. A hybrid physical prehension are thoughts or possibilities directly prehended from a past actuality.
Why does he call it hybrid?
Because it's a physical prehension, because it's what I would call a causal prehension, okay. But it's also a conceptual prehension. It's the only sort of causal prehension that's also conceptual. So Whitehead says, at the beginning of concrescence, each occasion has a prehension of the primordial mind of God, and that's how it gets its possibilities. So that would go along with what you're saying right there.
Okay.
Right? And that's a valid way to do it. I'm proposing something slightly different.
I'm proposing that whenever an actual occasion begins its process of concrescence, during the concrescence of a higher grade occasion, that higher grade occasion has some influence on its aim. Well, that, so God has an influence on the aims of all occasions, but then all occasions also have their aims influenced by those higher grade occasions with which they are in unison of becoming.
So how does that relate to the way in which the eternal objects form that halo of possibilities? I noticed in chapter 6 you talk about the necessity for God to give impetus in the right direction to everything so that there's relative order. But to me it's like, well, actually the laws of nature, or in this system the eternal objects, they seem to already have that capability. So I'm trying to...
The capability of?
Of pushing things in...
Right, but it's a question of how they're ordered. Now, there are two things about the eternal objects that are presented to an actual occasion. One is how they're ordered, and that's always coming from God, right? The primordial ordering of the eternal objects that makes them relevant to each other in the kinds of ways that we, for example, capture as logic and so forth. But in other words, the eternal objects have to be in order or they're useless. You know what I mean? We've talked about this a lot before, right? So the eternal objects have relevance to each other so that color is not a note and E is not a...
Shade.
Color, yeah, you get the same, right? So there's
right.
these relevance, right? So that comes from God. But also, according to Whitehead, and I'm sympathetic to this, in each moment, God stamps certain possibilities with his desire, her desire, right? And so those possibilities become sort of highlighted for us as being the best possible, the some way in which God is always showing us the way forward, even if we don't choose to take it. But I'm not sure I answered your question.
Yeah, I mean, I think I need to think about this more, but they're kept coming up in our conversation today. Something about a similarity between eternal objects,
okay.
sort of being outside of time and space.
In a way.
And these
infinite
actual occasions, which we felt the need for, even though we hadn't articulated it in quite the same way. And so there's a way in which they're both outside of time and space.
I wouldn't exactly say that eternal objects are outside of time and space. I'd say they're with time and space.
Right.
Which
yes,
is different.
Yes. Right? No, I understand. Yeah,
okay.
But that's what I'm trying to say. That they're yeah.
So, I think you were asking something about aim and eternal objects, right? And you were saying,
yeah.
why is the aim
yeah.
needed, since the eternal objects create the order? And the answer is that the aim is what influences how we choose which eternal objects to actualize. Right? So in other words, so the aim functions in at least two ways. One of them is as I am interpreting the data of the past world, I'm choosing what to ignore and what to pay attention to, what to highlight and what to minimize. I need some criteria for that, and my criteria is what interests me, which is to say, what conforms to my aim, right? So even though I'm presented with a set of eternal objects, which are partially coherent because they're all compatible with the past having been the way it was, there still has to be some criteria by which I choose both how to interpret the past and how to make decisions regarding the future. And the aim, the taste for value, is what allows those determinations to be made. Without that, it would all just be random. Okay?
Yeah.
Great. Okay, yeah.
So you're saying that higher grade occasions, their aim can affect lower grade occasions?
Yes.
So if we are a higher grade occasion,
yes.
how do we affect lower grade occasions?
Well, for example, I'm claiming that the unity of our body is the unity of aim. In other words, the reason our bodies hang together is because all the cells in our bodies are influenced by all the cells in my body are influenced by my aim. Right? In fact, it is my aim that determines whether the cell will become an eye cell or a lung cell in some way, right? So my aim, right? And then because my aim is the organizing principle of my body, And that sharing of aim encourages the other intelligences in my body to be receptive to the propositions that I articulate for them. Right? So if I say, arm, raise up, it raises up. If I say, cup, raise up, it doesn't. Right? Because my aim is not involved in the formation of the occasions making up the cup the way my aim is involved in making up the occasions of my body. Right? Now, also I'm suggesting that aim radiates, that there's a certain efficient quality to aim, right? And so, in fact, to some extent, we influence each other's aims as we can feel, right? So that's the kind of thing I'm talking about.
Because I was just kind of thinking about her question about plant spirit, and if we can influence a plant, in a sense, so that whatever chemical it has within it works towards our aim, it, in a sense, kind of blends what we're doing there.
I think that that is part of one of the key technologies of the integral era. I think that to learn to meditate with plants and animals in such a way as to be able to join our aims with theirs, right, would enable us to work with plants and animals in mutually enhancing ways that we can barely imagine right now. But I actually have a hunch that by doing that, we could induce beneficial mutations in plants, right? That they would just sort of get the idea and cooperate with us and mutate. But I think that's the kind of influence of aim and form and so forth that I'm aiming toward. I think that's the way we need to relate to the world around us and have a mode of production is through forming empathic and telepathic communications through which we can garden the biosphere into a mutually enhancing paradise. Yes?
I'm interested in the play, as I understand it, that you're describing here between the eternal objects setting up and the primal ordering setting up what an individual occasion will have as its probabilities. Some of the probabilities are set, maybe most of them, by the prior history that's all there. And then a very specific thing about that particular occasion is determined by the mind of God, namely its location and that it's going to begin, mm-hmm. if I understand you right. And I'm wondering how much, for example, of that determination sort of arises on the spot out of the possibility space.
How much determination?
How much is there sort of a top-down causation from the world of eternal ideas ordered? Do they order a little bit more specifically toward the occasion that's being started someplace?
Well, I think I understand your question. First of all, there's the primordial mind of God. And the primordial mind of God prehends all of the eternal objects and orders them. Right? Once and for all, at least for our cosmic epoch or our universe, eternal objects are ordered. Logic is set. Sort of the relevance of possibilities in order is set. Right?
To a point, right?
No, it's set. The logic of the possibility is set. All the possible infinite pathways that can be explored by actual occasions are just there. Okay? Once and for all. Then, at the moment of the inception of an actual occasion, there's some kind of filtering process such that only those eternal objects in the primordial mind of God that are relevant to the past of this occasion show up as its possible future.
So there's a little dynamism in
there. Well, there's a filtering of some kind, right? Because here, this moment, it seems to me there's a possibility for human beings with wings somewhere in the primordial mind of God, right? It hasn't been realized here, right? And so in this moment, the possibility of opening up the window and jumping out without dying is not present. But if I had wings, it would be present, right? And so each actual moment opens up a certain subset of relevant possibilities. It chooses from among all the infinite possibilities those which are relevant to this moment.
Right. So from that point of view, it says that the occasion itself is mostly is will be affected by and using the preset ordering of eternal ideas.
Every
as part of its possibility.
Every occasion does that necessarily.
That's part of its. That's sort of determined by its history and.
That's correct.
Specifics.
That's correct.
So the causality is not that God's up there changing things.
No. Now, what God may do is God may highlight certain of these possibilities as being particularly attractive.
Okay, then God is doing stuff in time.
Yes, that's correct. God is involved in time. Absolutely. This is for Whitehead and Fairbairn no more.
So that's a kind of top-down causality.
It's an element. There is an element of top-down causality.
And then...
However, now stick with Whitehead. This is not really causality for Whitehead, it's persuasion. Whitehead is, God is simply saying, this would be a really good idea for you.
Or seduction.
What?
Seduction. Seduction, not persuasion, but seduction.
I can't hear that word. Sorry. Solution?
No, seduction.
Seduction. Yes. Seduction, yes, seduction. Exactly. God is seductive, or in Whitehead's words, persuasive, and not coercive. Right, so this is Whitehead's idea. So then we get these may be a little highlighted, but the decision of which one to actualize is made by the occasion itself. Now, whether or not the occasion is participating in God's free will or what, we're leaving that out. But the occasion does have its own quantum of freedom, and it does make the choice. So it's not totally free. A, it has a finite set of possibilities available to it because only those compatible with its past are relevant. B, God may make some of them look a little more attractive, but it's the occasion that makes the decision.
Okay, so when you talk about a body and a higher level, high-grade occasion, setting aims for the thing.
Yes.
You know, science looks at everything from the little building blocks and builds everything up. So it's fascinating to look top down like this. And so is there a sense in which the high-grade occasion... I mean, my sense is that you can't have a high-grade occasion until you have all the lower-grade occasions.
No, that's not the correct...
Yeah, that's what I'm asking. Yeah.
Definitely not. That's one of the most important things.
Yeah, right, because it's not in the so-called physical world.
That's right. That's right. In fact, the ontological independence of actual occasions of higher grade is probably the most revolutionary thing I'm teaching here.
Yeah, man.
Right. Can you say that one more time?
The ontological independence of high-grade actual occasions. See, let me pause on that, because this goes right into the subject of today's readings. We're talking about the waking world, right? And in the waking world, I think it's fair to say, I mean, you could probably argue with me if you try really, really hard, but it's generally fair to say that in the waking world, everything we see is made up of physical stuff, made up of atoms in some way. Right? Maybe we could find exceptions, but it'd be hard. Right? So the world is the physical world. The waking world is rooted in inorganic actual occasions. Now I forgot what question I was answering.
Ontological
independence, right? Okay, so if we look at evolution, the history, we see first there are atoms, and then there are cells, right, and then there are plants, right, and then so forth, right, and they're all made up out of these original atoms or subatomic particles or whatever, right, and so we look at that scientifically, because we do our science when we're awake, and we say, okay, well, obviously, the atoms, the quarks, whatever they are, those are the real things, and everything else is combinations of them. And so in order to have any kind of organism, let's say, you got to have zillions of atoms and blah, 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 right? And so the idea being that everything in the waking world is nothing but a combination of atoms. Now, if the atoms are insentient, forget it. The whole thing makes no sense at all. But even if the atoms have a little bit of sentience, it still is not enough, because all you've got now is a multiplicity of individual, very poor centers of consciousness interacting with each other, but in no way have you accounted for living beings that have their own consciousness, their own central intelligence, their own different ways of doing things, right? And so I'm suggesting, as I've said over and over again, that when you move from this level, let's say it's the atomic level, to the cellular level, what you get is a higher grade actual occasion presiding over a system of lower grade actual occasions. And this higher grade actual occasion is what's responsible for organizing these interactions so they seem to be self-organizing. Okay.
Ah, wow.
Right? Now, so now we have these higher grade actual occasions, right? And the question is, are they ontologically dependent on the macromolecules or not? So if the cell is disrupted, can the presiding intelligence of the cell continue existing? That's the big question. I hope you can see that the answer to that question is the same thing as the answer to the question, do we survive bodily death? Right? You see that? Okay. So here's, now, what does it take for an actual occasion to come into being? What are the requirements? What's needed to bring it into being? A, creativity, right? The principle of the ultimate. As Sri Aurobindo would say, the consciousness force of Satchidananda. But whatever, creativity needs to be there for an occasion to come. We need God to provide certainly an aim and maybe a position, right? And then we need an environment. This is what it takes for an actual occasion, right? Creativity, God, and an environment out of which to grow. Now, the environment is particularly important for this reason. The grade of an actual occasion depends on the richness of its environment. Right? So, let's say you're out in the middle of intergalactic space and an occasion comes into being and it has the aim of a very high-grade occasion. It will be horribly frustrated because it has no rich data to chew on. Right? So the existence of high-grade occasions requires the existence of high-grade environments. You with me on this?
Not exactly the existence, though, but something to be more robust requires for others.
In order for it to conquest at a high grade, it has to have high grade data to chew on. Right? And that means that its data is its environment, is its body. Right? And so if the actual occasion making up me were to find itself in the middle of interstellar space, it'd be a lot worse than being in prison. I'd go crazy, I'd go nuts, because I got nothing to feed my aim. Right? And so an actual occasion requires God, creativity, an aim which establishes its grade, and an environment sufficiently rich so that it can process it in a high-grade way. Yeah?
But are there also grades of higher grade? Because the higher-grade personality that we are needs a much richer environment than the higher-grade personality, or the higher-grade occasion presiding over an atom.
Well, obviously, because that's a lower grade occasion than we are. There's a whole hierarchy of grades.
But we're calling them both higher grade.
Well, what I mean is that, okay, let me, in order for an occasion to exist at a grade appropriate to its aim, it has to have an environment sufficiently rich to permit it to function. Okay? Whatever its aim and grade is, right? So human beings require an ultra-rich environment. Atoms require a slightly richer environment than a subatomic particle does. Okay?
But they can both still be called higher grade occasions that preside in the transmissible worlds.
That's right, they're higher than lower grades. So higher is both a term of comparison as well as a term of description. I'm using it here in a comparative way rather than a descriptive way.
It makes total sense. Okay. It just caused confusion.
Sure, I'm glad you clarified. I really appreciate that. Okay, so now it seems to be the case that when there is a dissipative structure of macromolecules, it creates a pretty interesting environment, relatively interesting. Interesting enough so that a higher grade occasion of the cellular level can take an interest in it and become embodied in it. Right? Now the question is this. Suppose that this occasion here loses its body. Right? Now, in order to go on, it still needs an interesting environment. Where can it get an interesting environment? It can get an interesting environment from the other entities at its own level. Right? And so the objectification of any individual macromolecule is very poor. Right? The objectification of a dissipative system is richer. A lot more molecules dancing around, it's more clever, interesting, right? But the objectification of any one of these cellular occasions is infinitely more interesting than the objectification of any combination of macromolecules. And so we still have creativity, and we still have God, and we still have an interesting environment. And so there's no reason these occasions can't keep existing, even if they have no relationship whatsoever to the low-grade occasions of the inorganic world. Does it make any sense to you? Because this is how we can establish the reality of the transphysical worlds, right here. This is why Whitehead's theory is so useful in this enterprise, because it shows us an ontology which supports the existence of worlds, of transphysical worlds, right? In a very natural way. Yes?
It seems like such worlds could be things acting like archetypes and morphogenetic fields.
No, I'm talking about worlds. I don't mean that. By a world, I mean an environment in which finite entities are interacting with each other causally in the context of a coherent space-time structure.
Right, but when they embody lower grade occasions,
yeah.
They're organizing something.
Yes.
So as a lower grade set of occasions, all of a sudden you're in a dance with other
right.
things, which you don't know where they came from.
That's right.
So there's this sort of level upon level where
yes. That's correct.
There's a ordering. So all the way back to the primal ordering.
Yeah.
That's kind of a cool picture. And it's very non-science, of course.
Well, the point is, it's not conventional science, but whether it's unscientific remains another question.
Yeah, yeah.
Because what I will maintain is that nothing that I am saying would cause scientists to get results any different than what they get.
Right, right.
Yes?
That's right.
That's very interesting. This is a whole psychological subject that needs to be developed. It's very, very interesting. Because to a certain extent, I mean, we are happy when the richness of our environment matches the richness of our inner process. And if the environment's too rich, we get overwhelmed, and if it's too poor, we get crazy, right? And so there's this whole issue, right? And it's fascinating that sometimes high-grade occasions like ourselves will find themselves in places like prisons where there is no high-grade input, and this is a great cause of suffering. And so, I don't know how to work it all out, but you're right on. There's something very interesting about this.
And the ordering of lower-grade occasions, say, using your example that you mentioned of imprisonment. So
yeah.
If you were in prison and, you know, you're in intellectually higher grade
right.
occasion than fellow prisoners, and are you somehow ordering them?
Well, you could have the potential. And there are in a lot of different ways as well. So, for example, one of my teachers at elementary school used to talk about elbow magic. And elbow magic, here's how elbow magic works. Students would constantly come up to her to ask questions. And the minute they'd get to her elbow, they'd get the answer and go back to their desk. Mm-hmm. So she called it elbow magic, right? So I've noticed that people, I noticed that I make people smarter, right? I notice that people often will talk to me and will get all excited and understand something really well, and then when they leave me, they can't remember it. Right. I think we all do this to each other, right? We all have effects, right? So in some way, the sort of a high grade of my intelligence creates a field that invites other people to participate in, right? So in the jail, the same thing could happen, right? In some way. So again, these are wonderful questions. See, I've given you some conceptual tools. The conceptual tools enable you to ask these questions, but I don't know the answer. That's the fun, right? The point, I can't do everything, right? Well, I'm giving you the tools to tackle these questions and ask them. So these are the kind of papers I want to see. People taking these ideas and seeing how useful they can be in answering important questions like this.
Can I ask one last question?
Please.
So you're talking about God and aim, and it sounds like actualizing intention for us. Yeah, so your intellect may be an aim of God.
My intellect is not an aim. My intellect would be... The fact that I choose to develop my intellect is an expression of my values, my aims.
But you said God has aims for us.
God has aims for us, yes. So my aims come from God in some way, but not totally. Some of my aims come from God. Some of my aims come from my past. Some of my aims come from the people around me. Some of my aims come from the higher grade occasions in which I may be functioning as apprehension.
I would define all of that as God.
You could, but I find it more interesting to discriminate the levels, because then they're fun to work with. And you can separate them out and do things with them that are very relevant to psychology, for example. So I wouldn't want to lose those distinctions, because I think a lot of juice can be made from those distinctions.
But the decision to either act on an aim or not.
Yes, that's...
What's driving that?
Well, for Whitehead, what drives that is the quantum of freedom that each one of us is gifted with. It's our contribution to the creative advance. We're given aims. And some of the aims we choose, because our own aims are, we develop our own personal aims also as we go through life. And then a lot of the aims we're given. So we're given the aims. We're given a set of possibilities to choose among. Maybe even some of those possibilities are more attractive than others because of God's input. But finally, even though all that's conditioned, given all that, there is still choices to be made. And those choices are made out of our freedom. Now, is that freedom absolute freedom, as Whitehead suggests? Or is it an expression of God's soul freedom, as Sri Aurobindo suggests? That's another issue. But it is our freedom. It is our contribution to the creative advance that we make decisions that are left over for us to make. And that's how we become actual. And it sort of feels like that, doesn't it?
Yeah, it drives me insane.
What part of it? What bothers you?
I just want the answers.
Well, which answer do you want?
I want the answers as to why people decide to act in accordance with what I deem to be their self-actualization or not, like, regardless of environment or what they're doing.
Right. Well, like if you want, like I could. I have no idea if this would satisfy you, but it's just interesting that I could sit down and write an essay on that based on what we've been reading, right? And I don't know if it's actually in this chapter I talked about it, but later on I talked about all the different levels of the aims I just mentioned. Personal aim, the social aim, the cosmic aim, the divine aim, right? And I would say that a lot of our difficulties come from dealing with conflicting aims. And that often, if our personal aim is misguided, it will cause us to do extremely self-destructive things. So if I could create an explanation out of the conceptual materials I'm developing, whether that would satisfy you, I have no idea. But it could be done out of these materials. What?
I'd love to hear that.
Yeah, well, we can talk a little more about it. Yes, Laura.
I just want to make sure that I'm understanding correctly the way you're using environment. Is
yes.
environment the total field of relevant possibilities?
No, the environment is the total field of past actualities, past causal outcome. That's what I meant by it. Good question, but that's what I meant. I meant the.
And as for the ontological status of the environment, is it also an entity?
No, it's Whitehead would say it's a disjunctive diversity of actual occasions.
at the initially anyway. It's just the past before it's been organized into a whole picture.
But this would be also the same for one entity that would be supervising the set of entities living or evolving on the in the certain environment.
Well, I guess you know. I guess I spoke too soon. I mean, Whitehead might be construed to be implying that there's a cosmic mind, mm-hmm. and I think Sri Aurobindo would certainly be construed that way. And so it is probably the case that the past does have a certain kind of wholeness of its own.
Yeah, but I meant the particular environments that are ordered. That means that each of them has a presiding entity.
Which environments? I'm sorry.
Well, there are different environments, hierarchically ordered.
What? Hierarchically ordered?
Yes, and I'm asking whether each of these environments has its presiding entity, whether it is a being.
I'm interested in your question, but I'm just having trouble getting exactly what you mean. So, the environment. So, what do you mean? Specify what you mean by the environment.
Well, I can speak about Estra or Vital or about Superman.
Oh, those worlds.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. No, I wasn't particularly thinking
about
that.
So, in itself, is it an entity presiding over small entities? Is it a kind of physical body of the...
Is the physical world an entity? This question.
For example.
Any answer I give you will be completely speculative. Mm. Having said that, I suspect there's some way in which there is a presiding entity over the physical world, but I haven't figured out exactly how that would work. Certainly many of the theosophists speak as if there is such an entity. And they have some good logic behind it, and I just haven't worked out. Mm. There are two different levels of things going on here. One of them is that a lot of what we're dealing with here, the further we get from the details of immediate experience, the more speculative we're being. And when we start talking about God and about the entities that may or may not preside over the physical and the astral world and so forth, we're getting very speculative because we don't right now have any empirical way of asking the question. And so what we're really looking for at that level is what Plato would have called a likely story. And so I hold all of that very likely. How could I possibly know whether or not the physical world, the inorganic world, is presided over by some intelligence that holds it in place? I think it probably is, mythically, it would make sense, and I would probably want to, if I were constructing a theosophy, I would probably want it to look that way. But right now, I don't know the answer. It's just a question of what would look better in the logic, right? What would lead to more interesting conclusions at this point? However, I don't think it will always be that way. I think that part of what we have to start looking for is how these questions can be answered, but they're not going to be answerable by the means of 20th century science. They're going to require different types of activity to begin to verify these questions, things probably done out of the body, in lucid dreaming or mystical or trance states. And so it's going to require a different kind of science to answer questions like the one you're asking in anything but a speculative way. That makes sense?
Yeah.
But generally, I think there probably is such a thing. But
because without this, there would be some great number of types of existence, and there will be entities, and there will be something what you cannot identify. What would be the environments?
Well, the environment for me always consists of other entities.
Yes, but these entities use the possibilities that the environments present them with. And again,
each
this
one does, right?
Yeah.
So I'm not sure what you're getting at. I agree, but
That's okay.
Okay, but yeah.
There's this famous thing, about the criticalness of constants that evolve in the cosmological story that allow life and so forth. Mm-hmm. You know, things were slightly off, the mind tells us. And I wonder if, and that's a great sticking point, you know, it's a big difficulty for science. The best they can do is just postulate that there's infinite numbers of everything. We just happen to be here.
Right.
All kind of universes without life, etc., etc.
Right.
Which is highly cumbersome,
yeah,
indirect thing. But this stuff ought to give you possibly a way to see how, you know, the evolutionary process is hosted by all the structures in the involutionary process
that's
in such a way that the thing organizes. I mean, you need...
That's also...
If you have the right aim, these things follow.
Yeah, all that's correct, but there's one simpler point, which is that the reason that scientists have to postulate all these other worlds where things didn't work out was because they refused to take final causes into account.
Right. Meaning?
No, so I would suggest that the divine, whatever the ground is that gives rise to the universes of individuals in which we live, it has an aim and value. And so it's not going to bother to create a universe that's going to turn to dust in 2 seconds because there's no percentage in it, right? And so it creates the universes that have the right constants because those are the ones that are fun to create. Right now, if you want to deny that the divine has any purpose or any will or any volition of any kind, then all you can do is propose that everything happens and we're just lucky enough to be where it's happening in an interesting way. Because the whole point of that argument is to deny final causes in nature. That's the point of it. It's an idiotic argument which has no purpose but to deny final cause. And once you accept final cause, that argument becomes unnecessary and irrelevant.
I'm just wondering if it could be done in enough detail to actually talk about, get down to the level of talking about physical action and science and stages.
Well, that's been my whole project, right? Because I discovered that Aurobindo did not have the conceptual resources to allow me to do that, and that Whitehead does. And that Whitehead and Aurobindo tie into each other beautifully, and so you can think Aurobindo's theology and Whitehead's cosmology all the way down to subatomic particles, and it all works. Right? And I think there's a lot of... The whole point of my doing that, when I first came to school here, my question was, what would Sri Aurobindo have to say about the collapse of the wave function? And what would Aurobindo have to say about relativity? And the answer was nothing. Right? He made them possible, but he didn't say anything interesting about them. But Whitehead does, right? And so I think that I have developed a language in which what you're talking about can be done.
Yeah.
And I'd love to talk to you more about the details. Yes, Madeline.
Thank you.
Oh, okay. So let's see. So let me take a few minutes now and just briefly go over the topic of the chapter. And then after the break, we'll have our discussion section. So any questions about it? That would be the best place to start. Any questions that actually come from the reading? This is a bit of a summary chapter, and so it might bring up some of the earlier questions as well. So I talk about possibility and actuality and final causes and then the three-phase anatomy of process. I think we've covered all this pretty well, right? Feeling, interpreting, and deciding. And then I have a whole thing about grades of actual occasion. Any question for any of that? Or is that all now, by now, familiar to you? Linda.
Well, maybe this is just kind of the word choice you used, but it led me to have a question that Madeline had the exact same question written.
Well, that's important.
On page 6.
On page what?
Page 6 in the middle. You're talking about actual occasions not all being alike and a simple one being shorter.
Oh, yes. I can't find the page. I have a different page number. Go ahead.
Oh.
That's a different mind. Go ahead.
To a quantum, the speed at which we change in rho would probably be as undetectable and as uninteresting as a change is taking place in a rock would be to us. So,
In the newest version, I just added change it.
Oh.
Changed it in a rock over the course of an afternoon, I said. Anyway, go ahead.
Well, but just
so what's your question?
It made it seem like a quantum event, which is lower grade than us, by analogy, it would mean that the rock is of a higher grade than we are, because it's occasion
of taking place. No, see, that's not right. That's very interesting. The occasions of the rock are much more rapid than our occasions.
But the
But the rock lasts a long time because it's a society. It's a stable society.
Or possibly if it has a higher grade occasion than us that presides over the rock as a whole over the eons, then it would be a higher grade, longer occasion.
Oh, boy. That's really interesting, Linda. Yeah, I really have to think about that. I mean, in some sense, you know, I can imagine that the whole universe is, let's say, my wife had really imagined the whole universe as being inside one occasion, which is the infinite divine occasion. So what you're saying is certainly a plausible idea, but I don't, it makes me uncomfortable to think about applying it to an individual rock.
Yeah, we were talking about that. It would be an individual rock or like all rock.
Yeah, see, now it's quite possible that there are group souls. I believe there are group souls. Well, I haven't exactly worked out, again, it's one of those things that has to be worked out, right? But there's certainly a lot of people who claim that, for example, animals don't have individual souls, they have group souls. And that the transition, that what makes humans unique is that humans are the only species, or at least on only species on the surface of the earth, at least, that are one body, one soul. That's sort of what's unique about humans. Whereas the animals share a common soul, and by the same token, there could be a rock soul or a, who knows, right? So again, I don't know the answer to these questions, right? But you're asking the right ones. But what would make me uncomfortable about what you're saying is that if there were a higher grade occasion that lasted a long time, like you're suggesting, he would have to express itself in a richer way than just by being a rock, which is a very low-grade expression. So maybe there could be a higher-grade occasion, which is the whole planet, in which the rock is a part, right? But the rock itself doesn't seem to show the sign of being embodied by such a high-grade occasion that it would last like that.
I guess what it makes me think of is, okay, if I were a quantum, and the quantum couldn't even see our richness, what is it that we're not seeing that's so rich? Now that's just where I go. Okay,
well,
so
absolutely. Now that's the whole point. That's the whole point. I mean, in a certain sense, we could say that spiritual practices intend to elevate the grades of the occasion making up our stream of being.
But I think she's implying that maybe we haven't yet been able to elevate them to the level of a rock.
Is that what you're saying?
Is that sort of implicit? Yeah.
I mean, I don't know.
Basically, because what we both reacted to in what you wrote was you were using the example of a rock as having longer duration, and then you're saying longer duration is a higher grade.
But there's a difference between a duration of a society and the duration of an occasion.
It's just
extremely different.
The rock as an example.
Right. Okay. Well, I'm trying to clarify
that. Right. So that's what we want to.
Okay. So what I want to clarify is that the rock has longevity as a society, mm-hmm. whereas higher grade occasions have a longer period of concrescence, right? But not longer kind of duration like a rock does. In other words, a very fast cycling of rock molecules can keep a rock in existence for a million years, right? But they don't have to be high grade occasions to do that. But every high grade occasion takes maybe 1,000 times longer. Let's say that the occasions of the cell take 1,000 times longer than the occasions of the rock. Right. You see what I'm getting at?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So it takes a society in order to have a persistent form?
Yeah. The only things that persist in nature are societies. Okay. So anyway, all this stuff seems fairly straightforward. If you have any questions, I've talked about it over and over. And I talked about measurement, and we've gone over measurement before. Any questions about that? Okay. And then I talk about, we already talked about higher grade occasions presiding over lower grade occasions and this process of embodiment. And then finally the question is this: what does all this tell us about the waking world? And so the first thing is, very, very important, we're in the habit of referring to the waking world as the physical world. And this is a habit I want to invite you to break. It's a pernicious habit. growing out of collapsed assumptions of modernity. The physical world is the inorganic world, the world studied by physicists. Inorganic entities are the ones that can be measured very precisely, right? Because inorganic entities, in order to have measurement, you have to have inorganic entities that will hold constant as rulers and clocks. You have to have a metrical space-time, and anything which can be measured in metrical space-time is the inorganic. It's what physicists study. It's the physical world. And the world that we live in is not the physical world, right? Because the people in this room are not physical, right? Because living beings are not physical, because living beings involve the interpenetration of transphysical. And so each one of us involves transphysical entities that are embodied in the molecules of our body. Now, what's the significance of that? Why is that important? And how can we know it's true? Right? And so the first thing is to notice the difference in what it feels like to interact with inorganic things versus organic things. Now, I think we've done this exercise before. Let's do it again, right? If you pick up an inorganic object and you hold it and you really try to bring your consciousness into it, you don't get very far, right? There's not a lot there to feel. But if you pick up a puppy dog, it's completely different, right? Because when you pick up a puppy dog, your heart opens up. And you feel the wriggling in your arms, and you know there's a living being there, and there's a kind of heart-to-heart transparency between you and the puppy that isn't there between you and the rock, you and the pen, right? And so that's the feeling of medium-grade actual occasions empathizing with each other, right? So if you pick up a statue of a dog, it's cold. And if you pick up a real dog, it's warm. And I don't just mean that physically, temperature-wise. I mean it emotionally, right? So what I'm suggesting is that we are transphysical beings and that we are constantly relating transphysically to the other beings around us, right? We are all here in a web of empathic communications. We feel each other, right? And we're feeling each other because as medium-grade actual occasions, our causal objectifications in each other are emotional. You're feeling my feelings, right? That's part of the transphysical dimension of the waking world. And in the same way, you are feeling my meanings. I would go, well, Whitehead often refers to the way that language is incredibly elliptical. And what he means is that there's so little information in language that you've basically got to constantly be guessing to make any sense out of it at all. But in fact, it's not just guessing. What I'm saying is that if it weren't for the telepathic resonance that we have with each other, we wouldn't be able to understand the meaning of each other's words. Right? And so what I'm suggesting is that the physical world, the waking world, while it's grounded in physical molecules and atoms, is thoroughly pervaded by transphysical entities among whom we can count ourselves. Right? And so I'm suggesting that the world is different. Now, let's look at some of the implications of that. This suggests that the entire world is covered in an ocean of emotion. And we're all swimming in it, right? And that these emotions can organize, do self-organizing in incredible ways, right? So one thing I was playing with one day, I was imagining, you know, I read somewhere there's something like 8 million people masturbating in front of the computer screen at any instant of the day or night, right? And so I'm imagining this kind of like swirl of erotic energy, right? And I'm imagining it, if you were a psychic being on some other planet, you could look down at the Earth and see this seething spiral of frustrated sexual energy. It'd be sort of like that red storm on Jupiter, right? Right? Because there are these currents of energy that are going on. Now, if we don't take into account the self-organizing currents of emotional energy that are driving, look what's happening in the Mideast, right? There's some kind of huge current of emotional energy flowing through there, right? Now, if we don't take those into account, all of our history and all of our sociology are so much junk, because they're denying so much of what's causally effective in the kind of events they're trying to imagine. Also, you know, this has huge implications in psychotherapy. Jung was sort of onto this, but anybody who's really doing psychotherapy knows that it's based on empathy and telepathy. That's how it works, right? And if you don't know that, I mean, we have all this complicated language of transference and countertransference, but the fact is, it's empathy and telepathy that's going on in psychotherapy, and it's being able to consciously utilize those things without identifying with them. That's what really makes a good therapist. So what I'm trying to suggest is that our attempt to interpret the waking world in terms of the physical world is doomed to miserable failure. Yes?
I'm having a little bit of a problem with this perspective that feels really culture-bound to me, actually. Because in the sense that in learning more about indigenous cultures' perspectives on inorganic matter as infused with spirit and interacting in meaningfully spiritual ways throughout time with matter. And then, you know, white Westerners come along and squash that. It feels like, yeah.
Well, to begin with, I take what I'm saying as being in 100% solidarity with the indigenous perspective. To begin with, I would say that every atom of matter is God, self-limited and self-absorbed and self-divided, but has all the value and all the impact of the divine everywhere. The whole thing is completely sacred. And that by saying that the physical world includes spirits, I'm saying the exact same thing that the indigenous people are saying. I'm just finding a way to describe these spirits in a language which is at least coherent with our scientific way of thought. But I'm trying to give expression to the indigenous sentiment in language is more appropriate to my environment.
I'm just thinking of an example from integral ecology last semester that I took where we were talking about rocks and minerals, which have long been deemed as dead, you know, by the West, but are actually, you talked about the difference between picking up, like, you know, my bottle right here versus a puppy.
It's different.
But maybe not if I had been raised in an indigenous situation where that cup was infused with the spirit.
Are you trying to tell me there's no difference between a cup and a puppy for an indigenous person?
I don't know.
Well, you know, I actually, okay, now I'm going to bring attention to my own impatience here. I feel impatient with what you're saying. Because, first of all, I never implied in any way that matter had a minimal value. I never implied it was anything other than absolutely sacred and divine. My entire thrust all semester has been to suggest that everything in the universe has value for itself and has its own consciousness, right? And so I'm simply not doing the Western trip, period, right? And secondly, when I point out that my emotional resonance is greater with organic beings than with inorganic beings, I'm not claiming the inorganic beings are dead. I'm just saying they're not as much like me as organic beings are, and that the level of interaction, causal interaction that I have with them is different. Right? Now, it may be that if I had been raised indigenously, my capacity to empathize with the rocks would be greater. I'm totally open to that. In fact, the whole point of everything I'm saying is to open up a thought pattern which will let us be more like the indigenous in appreciating the rocks. Right, so I feel like I'm being criticized on a superficial basis that ignores the depth of what I'm saying, and so I'm feeling impatient. But I need help. I'm just opening this up because I don't want to hurt you or anybody else. I just want to follow what you're saying. It's okay. I have a little trouble here, so let's help me. Right? So I don't get mad. Yes.
I feel like I understand what you're saying pretty well. Yet I'm having the same reaction that Shannon's having.
So help me. That's why I'm asking.
I don't know that you're doing anything wrong. I think there's just a lot of information. It's hard to keep everything in the forefront. And so when we start talking about that example you just gave, our minds think, so you're saying that there can be nothing sacred about an inorganic object? Like that's where my mind went.
I see.
And it bothered me. But okay. I think we also have to distinguish between a cup, any cup or bottle, and a sacred object. So if somebody makes an object sacred, then you can have a different feeling.
But I also said that everything is sacred.
What does that mean?
But we may not feel the same.
Well, it means that everything's made out of God.
But then
that's very abstract, though.
Yeah. Sacred so implies something isn't abstract. Sacred, right? To say this is sacred is to separate it out from other things. Say this is special. Is that not?
There are different ways to use the word. That is, yes, one of the main uses. I'm using it in a slightly variant. I'm using it in a slightly different way.
Could we talk about force? Because I actually last week I was having the same sort of issue that this is, although I realized these weren't your intentions in the beginning, it seemed like it was becoming an idealism, a privileged mentality, or not necessarily privileged, but there was a philosophical divide between whether it's infinite, finite, mind, body, and we're still trying to figure out how that threshold is crossed. Mm-hmm. It seems like, because in order for the transphysical in order for the waking world to be seen as a cohesion of physical and transphysical, I guess, we need to cross that divide or that gap.
I don't understand what you're saying. I'm sorry. Okay. Yes, we have to cross it. Mm-hmm. I'm claiming that the transphysical occasions and the inorganic occasions are of the same ontological type, and therefore they can interpenetrate each other. And I'm trying to explicate the causal mechanisms through which that happens.
But if you talk about a rock as not having a presiding actual occasion, mm-hmm. that sounds like it doesn't have the same...
Spirit,
yeah.
Nature.
Well, look, is there an ontological difference of any significance between a rock and a giraffe, or a rock and a cell? Are they the same, or are they different?
They're very different.
They're very different. How do you account for the difference?
I would say one has more causal efficacy, because when it's a higher grade actual occasion, it can affect lower grade actual occasions more. So.
Well, yeah, I mean, but to go back one step before what you said, I'm claiming that the cell has the presence of a higher grade occasion that organizes it into a self-organizing system, and a rock doesn't. The evidence for this is that the rock doesn't behave in a self-organizing way. That's the evidence.
But if a rock is sacred and embodies spirit in a way that has causal efficacy through the through the action of something from a transphysical world, then I think that's where we're people are struggling in terms of trying to align this with, say, a shamanistic perspective.
So, something that I'm just going to throw in here, because it came up for me once when I was at a sweat lodge, where they actually addressed the rocks as stone people. Mm-hmm. And it came up as we were doing the prayer circle, and passing the talking stick, that the rocks were sacred, but they couldn't exercise the same level of choice that the people doing the prayer circle could.
Exactly.
And what actually came up was they couldn't fuck things up.
Right.
But that level of responsibility that comes with being that more complex actual occasion. Not that they weren't sacred, not that they couldn't be
exactly.
viewed with that.
Exactly, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Well, it sounds like we're confusing higher grade, or we're not saying it's more than, or it's more important than.
Right.
And I think that's where sometimes our language, like when I hear higher grade, automatically my brain is like, oh, better than? When you're higher, we think of better than. So maybe it's just a reevaluation of remembering that the same words we're using don't denote any sort of hierarchy of importance.
Well, they may also, I don't want to totally deny that either. I mean, evolution seems to drive toward higher grade occasions. So anyway, I'm very interested in this conversation, but I want to give people a chance to pee and take a break. So let's take a break and come back.
Some low grade occasion experience.
Yeah, let's come back at 1:35. Okay? We're going to have 5 minutes only for any burning questions that are left over from before, and then we're going to break up into discussion sections. So any burning questions before? Yes, Bill.
So when you talk about this telepathic communication and rivers of emotion.
Yes.
Great storms in the atmosphere or something. could those be societies? If we're going to have a dissociative group, is there at least a society for a period of us?
Well, there are societies on every level. And I know there are societies on the astral level and on the mental level. And exactly what their properties are, I can't tell you, but I'm sure there are.
But wouldn't it be useful to describe, like, the special coherence that happens in a group of people that are working on the same thing?
That's right.
Or friends and friends and whatnot.
That's right.
Do they get a presiding occasion?
I see, again, that same question comes up, right? Over and over again.
But it wouldn't need, a society doesn't need a presiding.
No, it doesn't, right? So a society does not have to be embodied. It can just be a society that's on one level of actuality. Right? Now, I do suspect, now White is actually quite clear about this, so I'm probably right, that actual occasions that are involved in societies are a slightly higher grade than those that aren't.
Huh. They get bootstrapped by the
collectivity, right? Because as I said, remember, to get very precise in terms of chapter 6, I suggested that actual occasions sharing similarities of form might more fully objectify in each other. That is, might be more intimate with each other. And so it could be that, like, even the rock, by virtue of all the occasions ingressing the common rock form, they may be more intimate with each other than they would be if they were scattered on the ground as pebbles. And so the rock itself may have a slightly higher grade, and therefore you could actually feel that when you pick it up, right? So, where'd she go? There could be a... I got that idea from your paper, by the way.
What's that?
you were talking about something, how groups that fell into some sort of resonance, and you talked about the rock having a resonance or something. And you'll have to go back and look. But
yeah, I said the rock would not have a presiding occasion in the thing I'm trying to work out would be a quantum coherent.
Yeah, the quantum coherent. That's where I got this idea, that if they were quantumly coherent, that it might raise all their grade.
Right, so we will have this discussion. Right? Right.
I mean, I hope it's okay with you guys that the theory I'm presenting is so incomplete. I sometimes think, God, you guys all think I'm a jerk. I'm just presenting this half-complete theory. But the point is that, you know, it's a scaffolding. It's the beginning of an immense work, and if I succeed, many it'll take many, many people to make this work happen. So. Michael,
In what sense can individual personalities be measured so that we can say that they're individual? If the personality isn't physical, because in the measurement section you say we can measure what is physical.
Right.
So, in what it seems like personality is a subjective measurement or an atomization of subjectivity.
What I'm claiming is that measurement, in the scientific term of using rulers and clocks, is inapplicable in transphysical worlds. So you can't measure it. The measurement doesn't happen there.
So, in personality isn't a measurement. It's not the same sort of.
No, personality is not a measurement in any sense. No, personality is the continuity of a sequence of actual occasions defined without any reference to measurement at all.
Well, you say measurement can exist in the transversal.
So it
can. I thought you could measure things, but you just couldn't measure time and space.
There's no measurement, period. All measurement concerns time and space. All measurement concerns rulers and clocks, time and space. That is measurement.
But if something resonates more strongly,
right,
you're still making a distinction that has some...
That's right.
At least has the flavor of quantification.
That's right. It can be more or less. You just can't measure it.
Okay. So you can distinguish.
You can distinguish,
but you can't
measure.
Can't divide.
That's right.
Let's say.
That's right. Certainly you can talk about more or less, more intense, less intense, higher grade, lower grade, but you just can't assign it to number. You can't assign those differences to a number line. That's all I'm saying.
But then you could say that this resonates more than this, But this resonates more than this, but less than this.
That's right.
You don't have a number.
That's right.
You're still,
and so that's still the point. That's brilliant. See, so that's the kind of reasoning that we can do in transphysical worlds, even though we can't measure. Right? So then my question is, how far can we push these things? Right? So you're right. We might be able in these transphysical worlds to more or less sort things into degrees of complexity. Or
and you might be able to count.
And you can definitely count.
Then somebody's going to say that you can measure.
No, because there's this huge distinction between counting and measuring.
Well, in measurement, you're measuring in terms of T, time, and D, distance.
Right.
So those are the variables of measurement in the physical world. I'm just thinking that maybe you have different variables in the transphysical.
Look, I know you guys read this chapter, and I've said this over and over again. I'm saying that measurement is only possible if you have inorganic occasions that will hold still as rulers and oscillate periodically as clocks, and if the time-space structure is metrical with zero curvature. Those are the only conditions under which scientific measurement is possible.
And then we find that even rulers are wiggly.
They're somewhat wiggly, which means that actually measurement is not possible at all. But it's possible for sufficiently practical purposes, it works.
Caleb, maybe you're trying to say transphysical measurement, like that's a different term. Yeah, I mean, measurement means physical measurement, but maybe there's a way to do something similar in the transphysical world.
I'm thinking there's got to be some types of measurements you can do that may not be time and space, but there are other types of measurements that can take place.
I don't know what they would look like, but I'm making a very specific point here.
But
it doesn't contradict at all what you're saying.
We're almost like sort of implying, though, but you're really kind of kidding, right? I mean, because it's really hard to drop the whole framework.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But again, like, there was this concept that came up last semester that Linda mentioned of transdigital numbers. And so I'm still trying to squeeze that in there somehow. I don't know
what that's about. But anyway.
Well, I don't know.
But the point is this. I am making the claim. And we all know that scientific reality in the modern world is inseparable from measurement. That physicists basically say what's real is what's measurable, right? I'm claiming that there are actual realities which really exist and have causal relations with each other and with us, but that exist in the domain where there are no rulers and no clocks and no parallel lines, and in which therefore scientific measurement is completely undefined. Yes, something else, other cognitive operations are possible there. Certainly classifying is possible. Certainly counting is possible. And certain forms of comparison are certainly possible. Fantastic. Let's see what we can do with those.
Yeah, you're right, because logic doesn't contain measurement.
No.
Logic is entirely about relationship. But there's no logical operator that actually measures something.
That's exactly right.
It just takes something that has been measured and relates it to something else.
Exactly. You got it.
But Boolean, greater than, less than logic.
Yeah.
That's right.
So logic applies, but not arithmetic. Arithmetic, but not measurement. In other words, you can have arithmetic and logic. And maybe even some kind of geometry. In fact, yes, definitely some kind of geometry, but not a metrical geometry.
But you know those optical illusions, you look at the book, it says, which line is longer?
Right.
And it turns out they're the same length.
Right.
So you're not measuring it with numbers, you're measuring with this intuitive sense.
That's right.
Right? And you're like, oh, that line's definitely longer than that one. But if you take a ruler out, you find
it's exactly
the same.
But in transphysical worlds, you couldn't find the ruler. And so there are no rulers. And so then you got a whole other epistemological can of worms. Right? And that's what I'm trying to say. Let's face that can of worms. What kinds of mental operations will help us to orient when we're in lucid dreams or dreams or out of our bodies? Not scientific measurement, but other forms of mental functioning, mental sorting.
It just seems that the purpose of the physical world is so we get to measure things, And the mistake is we've actually cut ourselves off from the other ways of relating things. And so we think that's all there is. I mean, it's like that's the goal. We wanted to be able to measure things and actually get to a restricted universe.
Right.
And that's the world where we do these measurements, and then we lost track of it because it was so compelling.
That's it.
And we have to reconnect it back up.
Brilliant. Brilliant. We have to get over equally. Yes, measurement is possible in the waking world. Yes, the inorganic occasions of the waking world are functioning in metrical space-time. Yes, physics works, but it's only a little tiny part of reality that it examines. Right? And there are other domains of reality that we live in that are totally relevant to every moment of our existence, but that we cannot measure scientifically, and we need other ways to conceptualize their objectivity. Yes, Bill?
It's interesting that spiritual schools seem to have some way or other, usually, of measuring the degree of development, realization of their...
Yeah, but again, putting those things in a hierarchy is not the same thing as measuring them.
No. I'm not saying it's a case of measurement. I'm saying it's a case of one form of subjective ranking.
That's right. Ranking is possible.
Yeah.
Right? Sorting, counting. Who knows what else is possible? Just not measuring.
Is value something that comes out of the physical world?
No.
So that's...
Value is intrinsic to everything. Value is intrinsic to the divine, and every actual occasion is motivated by an aim toward the increase in value.
I'm just thinking about hierarchies, and it may be hierarchies.
Oh, well, this is something I was talking to you about at break. So, apparently, it may be the case, Mikey suggested this, that people are getting confused because when I talk about higher grade actual occasions, it sounds like I'm talking about better actual occasions. And this confuses people. And so I think what I want to say is this, that I mean it. I do mean it, that higher grade occasions are in some way better. And the reason I mean that is because evolution, as far as we can tell, according to all the great interpreters of evolution that we study, evolution is about the production of complexity consciousness, right? It's about the production of higher grade occasions. So evolution clearly values higher grades of occasions. It doesn't mean to deny the sacredness and the intrinsic divinity of the lower grade occasions, but it does indicate that in the evolutionary process, there's a preference for the production of higher grade occasions. And so from the perspective of evolution, the higher grade occasions are more valuable. Now, from the absolute perspective, it's all God, everything is infinitely precious. But from the relative perspective of evolution, the higher grade occasions are more valuable.
Is that because they are more actively co-creative with God?
Yeah, you could say that. I'd go with that, unless that's an exhausted answer, but it's a right one. Yeah. Okay. So this is another burning question. We're going to have our discussion group now. Did you like the counting last time? Do you want us to do it spontaneously? Should we count off? What do you want to do?
I like letters.
Letters. How does that work? You organize it.
A.
What's the good of those letters? What are you going to do with those letters?
We'd have to start over.
We'd stop at D or...
Okay, stop at D.
Stop at D.
Okay. A, B, C, D. A, B, C, D. That's you, Bill. A, B, C, D. That's you. A, B, C, D.
A's over here.
Who's going to be the B's? B's. Okay, ladies and gentlemen. So what treasures did you develop that you'd like to share with each other? First, you guys were together, you talked nonstop. Now we're all back and you don't say a word.
Well, we decided we're going to start a new business. Linda, do you want to talk about it?
Oh, seriously?
Yeah.
Instead of genetically modified organisms, we'll have the transphysically influenced organisms.
That sounds excellent. I believe that will be the key to medicine in the integral age.
And then Caleb thought we should do what?
Instead of like the inefficient advertising system we have, we could just get psychics together and just start like getting people to buy your products by emanating, like aim out into the cosmos.
You know, some of the people who do out-of-body travel and write about it claim that there are people out there in the transphysical world trying to influence business decisions and trying to do spying and all kinds of stuff. And we certainly know for certain that the CIA during the 70s and probably the early 80s spent quite a bit of money trying to develop these methods. I don't get the feeling they actually got very far.
And when the Nazis into that?
Yeah, I believe so. I believe the Nazis were into it. And actually, if you start looking around the occult literature and the conspiracy literature, you will find a lot of people claiming that many high-level government and corporate officials are involved in various kinds of black magic. And if you really want to get out there, there are people who will claim that the King and Queen of England are actually lizards who eat people and, you know, stuff like that, right? But, you know, there's a certain boggle threshold everybody has. But on the other hand, it makes total sense to me that if there are what the Vedic people call asuras, or what we would call devils or demons, living in the transphysical worlds and taking an interest in the physical, in the waking world, they would find a very easy way to enter in through corporate hierarchies. In other words, the situations that are created at the higher levels of large bureaucracies are ideal for evil infestations. Mm. Right? Because number one, large bureaucracies tend to promote sociopaths. So the higher you get in the bureaucracy, the more sociopathic the people are there. Secondly, you get a lot of power. You get a power that's abstracted, that it's cut off from the reality of the people over whom the power is being exercised. And so it creates this kind of perfect, sterile atmosphere for the infusion of evil. And so I would suspect that at the higher levels of the corporate and government bureaucracies, you will find various evil societies that are, in fact, doing either devil worship or some other form of black magic, which would be perfectly consistent with their other methods. And so I take that as a plausible possibility that's actually going on.
Along the same lines, I mean, didn't Sri Aurobindo feel that he was contributing to World War II by fighting the Nazis
absolutely.
The Nazis, let's say, in the astral and other worlds?
That's right. That's what he claimed. He and the mother claimed that they were responsible for keeping the Nazis from overrunning Dunkirk.
So it seems that there's something about the physical world where the mixture of aims has a different quality than in the transphysical, and that there's a different type of influence that can occur here in the physical world.
In what way?
Well, I think part of it is the ignorance and the ability to purport yourself something that you're not,
and we can
choose to present how the abstraction we want to present to the other versus...
That's right. I think the higher you go, the further into the transphysical you go, the harder it is to lie.
Yes, that's exactly right. You're more transparent.
You're more transparent
to your environment.
That's right. It's not impossible, but I think it's much more difficult.
But rocks don't seem to lie. There's something that seems very authentic about a rock, and even plants, and maybe animals. So it seems the higher grade of the physical occasion implies. It's a weird kind of mirroring, right? The higher grade the physical occasion, the more possibility to be inauthentic.
That's correct.
And whereas the higher grade of the transphysical occasion, the less you are able to be.
Very interesting observation, and certainly true. And one of the ways that Sri Aurobindo handles that is that he says that evolution begins in unconscious universality. Right, so an atom, for example, doesn't act as if it has any sense of itself as an individual. It simply responds to its environment, which is why physicists can predict it. Right? But then as evolution proceeds, the various entities become more and more individual. They begin to have more and more of a sense of themselves as individuals. And so Sri Aurobindo suggests that evolution begins in unconscious universality. At the human level, it reaches conscious individuality. And then beyond the human level, it opens up into conscious universality. Right? So at the very beginning, you can't lie because no individual to lie. The possibilities of lying become maximal at the level of conscious individuality at our level. And then as we begin to merge back into our collective unity, lying becomes less and less possible and relevant.
So consciousness increases in how it goes from universal to individual back to universal.
That's right.
Then it goes from, but consciousness is always going like this.
Well,
wait, universal unconsciousness to
conscious individuality.
Yeah.
Right? So like, we are not conscious of the universe, we're conscious as individuals. But then we can become conscious universally. Something like that. That was just one of the. But I see what you're getting at, it's very interesting and important. Absolutely, yeah.
So the grade of our occasion, that is us, increases, or do we become, or do new occasions add to the embodiment as we go out into the transphysical world?
I don't know what you're asking me yet.
Okay. Levels of development, complexity levels, this maximum place that we have here, all paints a picture of a hierarchy of some sort.
There is a hierarchy. Evolution always implies a hierarchy of some sort.
Okay, so if you, for example, come to recognize that you're that you are a transphysical being, and you're stepping up, you know, towards open mind and so forth, are you a changing occasion that gets
occasions don't change.
I'm sorry, you're absolutely right. I'm talking about a form. Yeah. Okay, but the
personalities change.
Okay, then that's my personality question. Is there any more content to the notion of a personality as a type of occasion or society of occasions, embodied society of occasions? Is there anything distinctive? It's just like any other hybrid occasion, right? When you say personal, I take you to mean you're just saying that's how you project yourself into the thing.
No.
This is your occasion.
No.
No? Okay.
When I say personality, I have in mind something very precise. A personality is a personally ordered society of occasions.
What's the order?
The serial linear ordering is the ordering.
Okay, sequence of behavior. Perception.
The sequence of occasions.
Right.
So I'm an occasion, and in this moment, there's one of me. In this moment, there's one of me. In this moment, there's one of me. So I'm a series of occasions in personal order.
And any other society would also be a series of occasions in a particular order, but it's not my...
Well, for example, there could be a cloud of gas in a bottle. That's a society. It keeps on being a cloud of gas in a bottle, right? But there's no personal order involved, except maybe among the individual molecules. But there's no identity in the crowd.
Okay, so you're talking about the structure of different societies, and a personally ordered society has some structural.
It has a presiding actual occasion, doesn't it?
No.
That's not enough. Yeah.
It's very simple. It's so simple, you're making it complicated. But actual occasions happen. Sometimes actual occasions happen in such a way that they constitute a series. And what that means is that this occasion looks back into its own past and recognizes this particular occasion among all the other occasions as having been it in the past. And that it anticipates that there will be another occasion in the future that will also be part of the same society. And there's a peculiarly powerful completeness of objectification running through here. Right? So that this occasion is going to remember this occasion and this occasion much more fully than it will remember any of the other occasions that are going on around it. So it's just a sequence of personality. It's just a sequence of actual occasions. that bind each other together because each one identifies with the past sequence and anticipates a future.
Wouldn't there be other than personally ordered societies that also behave like this?
Well, there's all kinds of societies. I mean, you know, like this desk chair here is a society of actual occasions.
Well, the rabbit is a society of occasions.
A rabbit society of occasions, right? And it has a personality, which is a personally ordered society of high grade occasions that makes up its personality.
Okay, so personality is a kind of society with this tight binding across.
That's right, but of course each cell would also have a personal order right. For its society.
Oh, okay. So personal is general, is definitely not meant to refer to my actual.
No, it's made to refer to a personally ordered sequence of actual occasions.
I just don't know what a non-personally ordered sequence would be.
Well, this chair itself is not really personally ordered. The individual atoms are personally ordered, but the chair is not.
Organic, inorganic would be the...
No, because an atom is personally ordered. An atom is personally ordered because you can recognize it as anything you can recognize as enduring through time, the elements of which are self-organizing is a personality.
Okay.
And the chair is just parts that are kept together.
Yeah, by probably the laws of their own conservation and so forth, right? But they're not. It's not an organism. Right now, each atom is a kind of an organism, but the chair itself is just a sort of a heap of organisms that are held together more or less conveniently by the relations between them.
But you talk about shared aim amongst all parts being. Is that not necessary for personal order?
Well, it is to a certain extent because there is a personal aim that is transmitted through a personally ordered society.
And the parts of the chair don't have shared aim.
No.
That's what makes it not personal.
That's right. They don't have a shared aim and there's no presiding occasion. And also the chair itself has no identity which could be personally ordered. Does that make some sense, Bill?
Yeah, let Linda have
one. Well, I heard you asking something different when you first started. I heard you asking, because a personality grade can get higher as you go along
with
the evolution, right, is that then a different occasion color? But is it a different, actually a different personality? Or something?
Yeah.
So what that makes me ask is, in that chain, does it just kind of keep getting higher? Or is it also possible to have more than one personality embodied in your physical body, one kind of like an astral personality, one like a mental personality?
Yeah, okay, so there's too many questions, and they're all interesting. Let's start again, one at a time. So yes, first thing is, in a sequence, is it the case that all the occasions in a sequence have the same grade? Right? That's the question, right?
You were asking how it gets higher.
As a person develops, how does their presiding occasion or their sequence turn into something of a higher grade?
Well, there's no reason that the elements of a personally ordered society have to have the same grade. In other words, someone who's doing spiritual practice, let's say, is trying to arrange conditions so that the grades are going to get higher in the same personally ordered society.
Right.
Right? So there's nothing about a personality which binds it to a given grade. In fact, we notice ourselves during the course of the day, that the grades of the occasion making up our personality can be higher or lower. Right? I mean, there are moments when I feel like I can barely turn on the faucet in the sink. I have a very low grade occasion, right? Then there are moments when I feel like I can understand the universe. That's a high grade occasion, right? And so, you know, it varies. Right? That answered that question.
Yeah.
Now that you had another question you were asking, that was also really interesting.
Well, do you only have one personality embodied in you at a time?
No. Clearly, the human body is a collection of an almost uncountable number of personalities, because every cell is a personality, and certainly every major organ system is a personality. And so the body is a complete host of personalities. And indeed, it is probably the case that the physical body has a sort of presiding personality, and the astral body has a sort of presiding personality, and so does the mental body. And so it's a very complicated situation, But it does seem, at least empirically, that during the day, there is one at a time of me, more or less. Right now, really, I'm not even sure that's the case. I mean, as a psychotherapist, when I deal with people, I'm dealing with lots of people. Like, part of what I do as a psychotherapist is I watch the different personalities surface and go down in the course of an hour. And then I try to make separate relationships with the different personalities and help them relate to each other. Right? That's the fun of being a therapist. You get to work in that kind of liminal space in there, right? It's a really interesting place to work. So I don't take too seriously the idea that we have just a single personality. It's a convenient idea that I generally assume for the case sake of exposition, but I'm not really sure about that. And yes, there have to be men. The human being, at one point in the book I distinguish between the human personality and the human self. By the personality, I just mean this sort of me. By the self, I mean all these personalities that are constantly involved in making me up. Right? So this is very important. You see, in the sort of crazy modern view, where the whole body is dead, up until the miracle where some electrical impulse suddenly is transformed into an experience, you can just have one personality. Right? But in the process model, every cell is a personality. Every organ is a personality, right? And so, not only that, but in the psyche itself, in the transphysical worlds, there are all these other personalities. For example, we all have idiot savants that are part of our personality. Anybody who catches a ball is exercising an idiot savant, because you couldn't possibly calculate the trajectory of a ball and work it out on paper in time to catch it, right? So there's an idiot savant that does that. And there are a lot of those little idiot savants that are built into us. And then there are these unconscious personalities and so forth, right? So it's a very complicated situation that we are.
Along similar lines, can one personality be embodied in more than one body at a time? Which is kind of, Michael was saying, how do you know that personality is individual?
That's a really good question. I mean, for one thing, I would say that any individual occasion, let's say my occasion, could serve as a prehension for a number of different higher grade occasions, right? And I'm not sure why I couldn't be partially embodied in your body also, right? And so I think there's a lot. See, one of the things that most fascinates me about this way of doing it, and one of the reasons I'm so excited about the way I'm differing from Whitehead, is because it makes the whole universe so much more profoundly transparent and open. Right? We're all participating in each other's beings in so many ways. And individuality becomes so relativized. It's important, but it's not absolute. And so all those things make this way of describing reality feel more like what it feels like to be in reality. Coming down to China, what I'm teaching you guys is so different from what everybody else is saying. This is really different. This sort of shocks me. How did this happen? That I'm teaching something so different. But I really appreciate you guys understanding it as well as you do.
In like free will and determinism studies, I spent a couple classes on that. The best example was that free will was just really a very small percentage inside what's mostly determined.
Right.
And I think I'm thinking personality in that kind of way, like most everything is really influenced by the other, and like that one thing that makes you distinctly unique and different from everything else is such a very, very small part of who you are, and most of what you are really is.
That's
right. Continuous flow with everything.
Exactly.
Exactly. It's just like the edge of a blade. Just
that's
like a sharp
it.
Little...
Like the whole universe, everything that ever happens, conditions me. The ordering of the eternal object conditions me. God's impulses condition me. I'm a conditioned being.
But within that, there's a spark of freedom.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Spark. Yeah, very.
Yeah, that's right.
It makes all the difference because we can actually possibly get doing that.
That's right. In other words, we can use the spark of freedom that we do have to increase the grades of the occasions that are occurring in our stream of being, and thus to develop a deeper, wider, and more profound comprehension of the world in which we live, up until the point where we may actually be able to merge into the infinite occasions of our souls.
The soul is...
I'm defining it here as that the souls are actual occasions which have no abstraction in objectification among them. Right? So they know each other with absolute intimacy. Even though they're individuals, each individual knows all the others as well as it knows itself. So that the souls are universal individuals.
Could be, yeah. Their distinct, separate uniqueness, or whatever you want to call it, is determined by their particular association with some other part of me.
I suspect the uniqueness of souls is very difficult to work out, but I think it has to do probably with a different taste for value. That every soul has its own unique style of valuing. I worked it out in chapter 12 as a hypothesis.
And when you say there are actual occasions, those are then infinite actual occasions?
The soul would be an infinite actual occasion, yeah. And then there's spirits and so forth, so. Yeah.
I don't know if you addressed this at all, but you're talking about conditioning and the spark of
freedom.
How do you conceptualize conditioning as karma?
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, I think that again, in chapter 12, I talk about this quite a bit, but I think that if you look at a personally ordered society, one of its characteristics is that there's a very concrete objectification running through here. In other words, very accurate memory, and that what happens back here in the chain has a big effect on what happens here forward in the chain, whereas what happens out here might have very little effect. Right, so there's sort of a concentrated stream of causal influence that moves through personally ordered societies and is at least a good part of what is meant by karma. I don't want to claim to be exhausting the notion of karma, but at least a lot of it is captured here in this idea of the way that these sort of causal tubes. And I talk about it a lot more in the last two chapters of the book. Yeah. Last question.
Defining a soul that way, first of all, I mean, it's a jump to an infinite occasion from what we've been studying, so that's
pretty
murky, as you say.
Yes.
What do you want to do with this soul structure? How does it fit into the scheme?
Well, I can't justify any of this, but I'll just tell you what Sri Aurobindo says, and that is that the soul is the reincarnating entity.
Right.
And it's the evolving entity. It's actually the soul dwelling in the secret cave behind our hearts expresses itself as an instinct for the true, the good, and the beautiful, which is what drives us forward in evolution. And that ultimately, if we learn to identify with the soul, exactly how that works we have to work out, that becomes what Sri Aurobindo calls the psychic transformation, and is one of the most significant events in the evolutionary journey. Because it systematically breaks the excessive identification with ego, which dies at that point. Okay, on that very speculative note, we'll stop for today. Chapter 8, next time we talk about the actual structure of the transphysical worlds.